Riley parked the car on the side of the street opposite the house and sat and watched the property for a few minutes, not wanting to rush into anything. The SUV that Cade had borrowed was parked in the driveway near the entrance to the house, the driver's door standing open. The lights were on inside the house, but Riley didn't see any movement through the windows, and he had the definite sense that no one was home. Reaching down with his right hand, he unseated his pistol from the holster he was wearing gunslinger style around his right thigh, and then reseated it again. He didn't want the weapon getting stuck if he had to draw it suddenly, and there was no doubt that the situation had him on edge. Doing what he could to keep an eye on the house and the SUV at the same time, Riley walked up the long driveway and approached the Suburban. The interior light was off, but there was enough ambient light coming from the house to let him see that the keys were still in the ignition. Had Cade been in such a rush that he'd simply left them there? Or had he been planning on leaving in a hurry and hadn't gotten the chance? His apprehension growing, he climbed the steps and crossed to the door. This close, he could see that it was held on with one hinge and had been simply propped in its frame. Riley's heart skipped a beat at the sight. With his pistol extended in front of him, he reached out with his other hand and gently pushed the door. Through the gap in the door, he could see something was pushed up behind it.
A sofa?
Planting his feet more firmly, Riley put his hand flat against the door and gave it a solid shove. He had just enough room to slip inside and step past the couch that had blocked the door. The house felt empty, even more so now that he was inside. But he was too good a soldier to take something like that for granted. He moved through the first floor, living room, foyer, kitchen, family room. When he was satisfied that the first floor was as deserted as he'd suspected it to be, he made his way up the staircase to the second floor. The room at the end of the hall beckoned, the fire-blackened door and obvious interior disarray like a magnet for his attention, but he refused to be lured into making any hasty moves. He cleared the two bedrooms on either side of the hall and then the bathroom just beyond, before moving to satisfy his curiosity with the final bedroom. The charred blast circle near the edge of the door showed where it had been hit with a bolt of arcane power, proof enough that someone other than Cade had been in the house, and recently. Had he gotten some kind of warning that someone had breached his defenses? Had that been why he'd rushed out of the warehouse? Cautiously, Riley stepped forward into the room, gun at the ready, turning as he did to take in the entire interior. There was no one there. This room, like all the others, was empty. It was clear that a struggle of some kind had taken place within its confines, however. If the damaged door wasn't enough evidence, the slashed bedsheets, crushed bookcase, and tattered paperbacks lying all over the place certainly fit the bill. Who or what had Cade been fighting? From the window in the back bedroom, he had a good view of the rear yard, and looking out, his gaze fell on the converted barn that served as Cade's workroom and study. Riley had been inside quite a number of times, most recently when he'd helped save Cade's life after he'd exhausted himself hunting through the beyond for the soul of his dead wife.
Correction, not dead, but not quite alive either.
The thought of Cade's wife, Gabrielle, caused another memory to surface in Riley's mind. Cade had exhumed his wife's coffin several months ago. Riley had helped him do it. The night commander had been suspicious that his wife had not perished at the hands of the adversary, but was actually trapped in some purgatory-like realm between the lands of the living and those of the dead. He'd been right, too. They'd found Gabrielle's body lying inside on that bed of satin, perfectly preserved. There had even been color in her cheeks, as if she was just about to get up and begin the day anew. The average person would have freaked out at the sight, but the supernatural was a regular part of Riley's day-to-day existence, and Gabrielle's strange stasis was barely a blip on his oddity meter, given what he dealt with on a daily basis as a member of the Echo team. Riley had helped Cade bring his wife home, but had forgotten all about her in the events that followed, including his own near death at the hands of the adversary.
So what happened to Gabrielle? Did the adversary's death free her in some way? Is she what Cade has been fighting to protect?
More questions, too few answers. And he wasn't about to find any while standing around here. There was still a chance there was something to learn in the workroom out back, so he retraced his steps through the house and left via the back door in the kitchen. He headed for the large structure behind the house. A pair of doors on rolling tracks provided entrance into the workshop, and Riley found them unlocked. The barn's original structure had been gutted and rebuilt, turning the lower floor into a well-furnished study. What had once been horse stables was now a large open room with bookshelves covering every available inch of wall space and several work tables arranged in a semicircle in the middle of the room facing the door. A wood-burning stove, now cold and dark, stood in the far corner, its black pipe running up through a hole in the floor to the second story high above. The large circular mirror that had once occupied the center of the room through which Cade had accessed the beyond was gone, and the enclosure that had turned the hayloft above into an enclosed room had also been torn out, leaving the space open and bare. A quick check showed Riley that Cade's go bag, the one he kept stocked and ready for an emergency call-out, was missing, as was the sword that was normally stored in its place of honor on the wall. The missing equipment made Riley realize that Cade's personal vehicle was missing from the driveway outside as well. Cade was gone, and he'd taken his gear with him. Riley holstered his weapon, reached into his pocket, and took out his cell phone.
We need to talk. Call me and let me know what's going on, Cade. People are starting to get worried.
He didn't bother leaving his name, knowing Cade would recognize his voice. He just hoped his friend would call him back before things got worse. As Riley was going methodically through his house, Cade stepped up to the TSA agent at the podium, handed over his passport and boarding pass, and calmly waited while his paperwork was being examined. In exchange for the safe return of his wife's body, the necromancer had demanded that Cade carry out three specific tasks. Cade had little choice but to agree. He didn't have the slightest clue where the necromancer might be hiding, and couldn't afford to endanger Gabrielle while he worked to track the necromancer down. Better to go along with Logan's request and wait for the opportunity to turn the tables on the other man when and if the chance presented itself. Given that Cade's cooperation depended on Gabrielle's continued well-being, he was fairly confident that she would be all right for the time being, even in Logan's hands. The TSA agent glanced at Cade's face, then at the picture on the passport.
Your destination?
The information was right there on his boarding pass, but Cade smiled just the same.
Paris.
He knew better than to add any additional details. The less said, the better, for it reduced the chance you'd screw up later if someone tried to catch you with your own contradictory statements. The TSA agent gave his damaged face another quick look and then made a quick checkmark on Cade's boarding pass before handing his documentation back to him. The passport was technically genuine. It had been officially issued by the Vatican with his picture on it, but it was under a false name and had been one of the cover identities the Order had provided for his use while head of the Echo Team. Of course, there was the chance that the Order would have flagged all of his passports, or at least those they knew about, but he didn't think he'd given them reason enough to do so yet. The time would come, he was certain of that, but he thought he had a few more days of free movement before they started seriously trying to track him down. Hopefully, he would be finished before then. He stepped over to the X-ray machine and handed both his duffel bag and his sword case to the TSA agent standing there. The other passengers gave him a few odd stares, but he ignored them. His bags were marked with Vatican diplomatic seals, and as such couldn't be searched or subjected to X-ray examination. He stepped into the body scanner, since the sword and firearms the bags contained would no doubt cause a bit of an incident. He collected his bags on the other end and then headed for his gate. Cade had booked a first-class seat on a direct flight out of New York to Paris, and the plane was boarding when he arrived at the gate. He stored his bags in the overhead compartment and then settled into his seat, his thoughts on what was to come once he reached France.
Can I get you a drink, Father?
Cade didn't realize the flight attendant was speaking to him until she put a hand on his wrist.
Father Evans, would you like a drink?
Yes, please. Orange juice, if you have it.
Of course.
As the flight attendant moved to the galley to comply with his request, Cade mentally kicked himself for momentarily forgetting who he was supposed to be. His anxiety over Gabrielle was worse than he realized. His passport had him listed as Father Michael Evans, a priest traveling to Paris on Vatican business, and he was dressed for the role in black pants and shoes, black shirt, and the thin piece of white plastic that was often jokingly referred to as a dog collar. He needed to clear his head and get with the program, or he could screw it all up before he even got started, and Gabrielle would suffer for it. After the attendant had dropped off his drink and moved on to deal with other passengers, Cade draped a blanket over himself and settled in for some rest. Flying time was just under 7 hours. With a 6-hour time change between the two cities, he should arrive in Paris just before lunch. That should give him plenty of time to rent a car and make the drive to his destination in the Pyrenees Mountains before dark. He didn't want to be on those narrow mountain roads in the middle of the night if he could help it. With that in mind, he drifted off to sleep. For the first time in months, the dream returned. He stands alone in the center of the street in a town that has no name. He knows from previous experience that just a few blocks beyond this one, the town suddenly ends, becoming a great plain of nothingness, the landscape an artist's canvas that stands untouched, unwanted. This town has once again become the center of his universe. Around him, the blackened buildings sag in crumbling heaps, testimony to the battles he has fought here on previous visits. The sky above the ruins is growing dark, though night is still hours away. Dark gray storm clouds, laced with green and silver lightning, are rolling in from the horizon. The air is heavy with impending rain and the electrical tension of the coming storm. In the slowly fading afternoon light, the shadows around him stretch and move, reminding him that they have teeth of their own. He turns to face the length of the street before him, expecting to see his foe emerge from the crumbled ruins at its end, just as he has emerged each and every time they have encountered one another in this place, as if his enemy is always there, silently waiting with infinite patience for him to make his appearance. For the first time, however, the street remains empty. His enemy is not here.
Of course not. The adversary is no more. You destroyed him.
But the sense of expectation remains. The wind is stirring the hairs on the back of his neck, and in that wind, the voices act as a physical force, pushing him forward from behind. And before he knows it, he is striding urgently down the street. As he does so, the scene shifts, wavers, the way a mirage will shimmy in the heat rising from the pavement. When the world solidifies once more, he finds himself standing in a cemetery. He recognizes it. He has been here before as well. Large, carefully sculpted angels adorn the nearest of the gravestones, with only the word Godspeed carved beneath them. Older, more decayed stones decorate the other burial plots nearby, but he is not close enough to see the details etched there. A feeling of urgency grips him in its bony fist. It forces him into motion, and he sets off across the lawn, winding in and out between the stones, letting that feeling guide his passage until he sees a small plot set off from the rest by a white picket fence. In the strange twilight, the rails of the fence gleam with the wetness of freshly exposed bone. The coppery tang of blood floats on the night air. As he moves closer, he can see that the earth on the other side of the fence has been freshly disturbed. A grave lies open, a gaping hole in the peaceful sea of green grass that surrounds it, filled with darkness deeper than that of the night sky above. This intrusion of the landscape and of the sanctity of the place draws him closer still, pulling him in toward it, the way a fly is coaxed into a spider's web. He stops just short of the small fence and gazes down into the darkness of the grave. His wife's body lies resting at the bottom of the grave, dressed in the same clothes she'd been wearing earlier that morning, the clothes Cade himself had dressed her in. Gabrielle looks so peaceful lying there, a faint smile upon her lips. That's when her eyes pop open, and that faint smile stretches into a terrible grin.
Hello, Cade.
For a moment, he didn't know where he was. Then he looked around. He was on a plane, headed for France, to steal the hand of a dead man on behalf of one of his most despised enemies. Just another day in the life. Upon arrival at De Gaulle, Cade quickly exited the aircraft, quickly cleared customs, and made his way to the rental car counters, where he rented a mid-sized sedan for his drive south to the mountains. He stopped at a cafe on the way out of the city and grabbed a few sandwiches to eat on the way, not having had anything to eat since early the night before. The sky was clear, the weather was nice, and for a time he lost himself in the simple act of driving. The abbey was located high in the Pyrenees Mountains. It had started out as a convent in the 1500s, was abandoned about 100 years after that, and then stood vacant until a sect of Benedictine monks purchased it just before the start of the French Revolution. It sat on the edge of a high promontory, like a castle guarding the approach to a mountain pass, and indeed even looked a bit like a castle, with its high crenellated towers and balconies jutting from walls of fashioned stone. The abbey was closed to the public, a tour available by private invitation only, but Cade had no doubt that they would let him in. Even the Benedictines answered to Rome. The winding, twisting mountain road eventually brought him to the entrance of the monastery complex. Two large iron gates blocked the road. Cade was forced to get out of the car and ring a small bell hanging to one side. A brown-robed monk emerged from a gatehouse on the other side of the fence at the sound.
May I help you?
I'm here to see Abbot Martin.
He usually doesn't have visitors, and I do not remember there being any on the schedule for today.
I am Monsignor Evans of the Office of the Sacred Congregation for Propagation of the Faith in Rome. I do not believe I need an appointment to carry out my duties, do you?
The monk paled at his words. It seemed the Inquisition still put the fear of God into people, as it had been designed to do.
My apologies, Monsignor. I will inform him that you are here.
10 minutes later, Cade was being escorted into the abbot's office, a Spartan room that contained little in the way of furniture and even less in material comforts. Cade mentally approved and felt bad for the subterfuge he was about to engage in, but it couldn't be helped.
What can I do for you, Monsignor?
The abbot was a tall, slender fellow with a narrow face, thin lips, and a high forehead.
Please, have a seat.
Cade didn't.
Sorry to disturb you unannounced. His Eminence, Cardinal Bollinger, had ordered that an inventory be taken of all relics currently in the hands of the Church. I have been ordered to view each and every relic personally and to report on their storage and care.
Quite the task.
That it is. Ours not to question why and all that.
Quite right. I did not have anything on my schedule this morning, so why don't I take you to see the hand myself?
That would be fine.
The abbot tried to make some small talk about life in Rome as he led Cade through the complex to the cathedral itself, and Cade fielded his questions as best he could. The cathedral was just what Cade expected for one built in the 1500s. Soaring ceilings and buttresses upon buttresses, with an altar decorated in gold and precious gems. The abbot walked through the nave, or center of the church, skirted the altar, and walked along the outer edge of the north transept until he came to a small wooden door half hidden in the paneling. He removed a key from around his neck and used it to unlock the door.
This is the Chapel of the Sacred Hand.
The abbot turned on the lights via a switch to his right.
This reliquary containing the artifact is kept in an alcove inside the chapel, and the door to the room is always kept locked.
How many keys are there, and who has access to them?
Cade pretended to examine the door. What he was really looking at was the lock. It was an old-fashioned tumbler lock that he knew he could have open inside of 3 seconds.
Just two. A master key, which I carry at all times, and a key specifically for this lock, which is kept in my office and used only on the days when the chapel is to be cleaned.
How often is that?
Once per week.
I see. May I?
Cade gestured ahead of them.
Of course, Monsignor.
Cade stepped into the room. It was small, maybe 8x8 at best, and contained 4 rows of wooden benches arranged before the alcove at the back of the room holding the reliquary. The reliquary itself was impossible to miss. It was an ornate gold and glass enclosure, shaped like a miniature cathedral, with tall panes of glass like the windows on the church through which the penitent could see the relic. The rear of the alcove was lined with mirrored glass, no doubt intended to reflect the beauty of the reliquary so as to make it appear larger than it actually was. Inside the reliquary, on a red satin pillow, was the mummified hand of a human being. The skin, brown with age and cracked in several places, looked more like shoe leather than human flesh. The fingers were unusually long and were slightly curled toward their tips, the nails dark gray and lusterless. The palm was intact, and there was about an inch of the wrist attached. Church legend had it that this was the hand of Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, a former French abbot, founder of the Cistercian order, and known through history as a man heavily involved in the Second Crusade. Cade's research had shown that Bernard died in 1153 and had originally been buried at Clairvaux Abbey, only to be exhumed and have his remains moved to Troyes Cathedral in 1792. And that's where things got interesting. When the body was exhumed, it was discovered that Bernard's entire right arm was perfectly preserved, almost as if he'd been laid to rest that very afternoon instead of 600 and some odd years before. The soldiers lopped off the arm at the elbow and reburied Bernard without it. In time, miracles began to be associated with the relic, healings and resurrections and the like. And as word got back to the church, the Pope had ordered a full investigation. Cade didn't know what had happened to the rest of the arm, only that the hand had eventually come to rest as a holy relic in the care of the brothers at the monastery, where it had spent the last 300 years. He studied the case for a moment, the abbot by his side, and then turned to face the other man.
Alarms?
No. The Abbey's resources are strained enough as it is, and we couldn't afford the monitoring costs. Too far outside the city, we were told.
Cade shook his head, by all appearances commiserating with the difficulties the abbot faced. But inside, he was smiling. He'd been afraid the hand would be locked away behind museum-quality security systems, which would have taken considerable effort to penetrate. He could have defeated them, given enough time, but was pleased to find out that doing so wasn't going to be necessary. Cade went over the wall just after midnight. The section of the wall where he crouched was in darkness, so he stayed there a moment, looking about. The cathedral was off to his right, across an open expanse of ground, but he wasn't concerned. There weren't any lights or roving guard patrols to deal with, and he was confident in his ability to reach the building without being seen. He didn't see anyone moving about in the courtyard, so he hopped down to the ground and began moving cautiously along the inside of the wall, staying to the shadows as much as possible. The main entrance was well lit, so he ignored it, moving instead around to the south side of the building. While touring the facility earlier with the abbot, he'd seen a side door at the back of the south transept through which he could gain access to the interior of the cathedral, and he headed for that. As expected, there was only a single bulb casting a weak light over the door. Even better, the door was unlocked. Inside, the cathedral was dark, with only a few nighttime security spots here and there about the room, providing just enough illumination to see by. Cade paused inside the door, letting his eyes adjust to the shadows, wanting to be certain that the sanctuary was empty before he made his move. When he was satisfied that it was, he slipped through the transept, past the altar, and went to the door to the chapel on the other side of the building. The chapel was locked, just as it had been earlier. Cade pulled a set of thin metal picks out of his pocket and went to work. Cade didn't bother with the lights. Instead, he took a small flashlight out of his pocket. The red lens preserved his night vision while still giving him enough light to work by. Now able to see, he moved to the reliquary. He didn't have the patience nor the time for subtlety. He slid the blade of the knife into the crack between the door and the frame of the reliquary. After putting the knife away, Cade reached into the case and withdrew the hand. He could feel the power emanating from the thing and was suddenly very glad for the gloves he habitually wore. Given his gift, he didn't want to think about what it would have been like to touch the relic with his bare flesh. He wrapped it in a piece of satin he took from his pocket, and then slipped the now wrapped relic into the messenger bag he'd brought along. Satisfied, he turned, only to find that he was no longer alone. An elderly monk, clad in the Benedictine Order's usual brown robe and sandals, entered the room. Cade instinctively went for his sword.
Lavalor!
The flat side of Cade's sword blade struck the monk just above the ear. Cade shut the door, then rushed over to the older man, worried he might have to deliver another blow to keep the old man quiet, but there was no need. Cade's first blow had knocked the man into unconsciousness, and there was already an egg-sized lump forming on the edge of his skull.
Sorry, old-timer.
But the damage had been done.
Oh, damn it.
Cade glanced around hurriedly, looking for another way out, but the door he was standing next to was the only way in or out of the chapel. The minute Cade opened the door even a fraction of an inch more, they would see him, and once that happened, he'd have to fight his way through. There was no other way to get around them in the narrow confines of the transept. He was trapped. He backed away from the door, sword in hand, wanting to give himself enough room to maneuver if the men came through. He was looking at the reliquary, wondering if he could lift it easily enough to use it as a missile to toss at the other men's heads as they entered the room, when his gaze fell upon the mirrored glass covering the walls at the back of the alcove.
Ah, mirrors.
He smiled at the sight. Riley spent most of the day following Cade's disappearance, running down information about the men in the warehouse, trying to find something that might link them to the necromancer. Fingerprint analysis provided him with the victims' identities pretty quickly, thanks to the fact that most of them had been arrested for minor issues in the past, vagrancy, public drunkenness, and disturbing the peace, to name a few. The morning had barely begun when he received a call from Preceptor Johansson. It seemed that a monastery in France had been burglarized the previous evening.
The thief made off with a holy relic, the hand of St. Bernard of Clairvaux.
I can't say I've ever heard of it.
I'll spare you the history lesson, then, and simply say that the hand was rumored to be able to heal the sick and to raise the dead. It's the latter that we're concerned with.
Riley would have bet the preceptor had never heard of the relic before that morning, but he ignored the veiled insult.
What makes you think it was the necromancer?
The hand has been in the monastery monastery for hundreds of years undisturbed. Then the necromancer escapes, and suddenly one of those few holy relics that have been linked to resurrecting the dead suddenly goes missing. That's too much of a coincidence for me, Night Captain.
It was thin, but it was the best lead he had at the moment.
How many injured and dead?
None.
None?
An elderly monk was injured when he surprised the intruder. But he wasn't alone, and several other monks came to his aid. In the process, the thief escaped.
Riley's doubts returned. The necromancer had left a pile of bodies in his wake during both his escape and the subsequent ritual he'd performed at the warehouse. Doing so was practically his signature at this point. Hell, if given the chance, he'd probably kill just to be able to flex his powers and bring the dead back again under his control.
So why didn't he do the same at the monastery? Why did he allow the monks to live?
There's a jet standing by at LaGuardia to take you and your team to Paris. I want you over there while the trail is still hot. Find this guy and find him quickly.
Cade burst back into this world. He lay there, staring at the wood floor mere inches from his face, and wondered just where in creation he was. Travel through the beyond was always interesting. Time and distance worked differently there, so Cade not only didn't know where he was, but he also didn't know when. Mere moments could have passed since he'd launched himself through the mirror at the back of the chapel, but hours, even days, were just as likely as well. The only thing he knew for sure was that he'd returned to the world in the same way he'd gone out of it, through a mirror. The one he'd come through was in the bathroom of a small home somewhere. Moonlight seeped through the window at his back, casting the room in its silvery glow. The pedestal sink, over which the remains of the mirror still hung, and the clawfoot tub beside it looked to be originals rather than pricey upgrades, and the paint on the wooden floor was peeling but had been lovingly touched up in the past. His sword and his messenger bag had made it back with him, and he took a moment just to double-check that the Hand of Glory was still inside. The door opened into a narrow hallway, lit by a nightlight plugged into a socket across from the bathroom door. By its light, Cade could see that there were doors to his left, all closed, and a staircase to his right. He quickly descended the stairs, made his way through the small living room, and let himself out the front door, just as lights flashed on through the rest of the house. He hurried down the drive, and only glanced back when he reached the road. He'd been right. It was a small farmhouse, empty fields stretching out behind it in the moonlight for as far as he could see. No help that way. Cade turned and began trudging up the road away from the farmhouse. It was a cold night, and he knew he wasn't adequately dressed for it. He'd intended to be back in his warm car long before this. The cold was eventually going to be a factor, and he knew he either needed to find a ride or shelter before too long. For now, he tucked his head down in his collar as best he could. 15 minutes later, the road he was walking on ended in a T-intersection with another larger road. He glanced both ways, saw lights reflecting off the underside of the clouds in the distance, and headed in that direction. A few minutes later, he came upon a roadside sign.
Toulouse, 5 kilometers. Paris, 426 kilometers. Well, that answers one question. At least I'm still in France.
He looked back and saw two headlights coming his way, lights that morphed into a full pickup truck as it drew closer. Cade stuck out his thumb.
Où allez-vous?
Do you speak English?
No.
Toulouse.
The old man nodded and gestured for Cade to get in. The heat in the truck was on, and Cade quickly shook off the chill that had started to envelop him. The clock on the dash said 4:35, which told Cade the time, though he still didn't know which day. He knew he'd find out sooner or later and tried not to let it bother him. A glance into the back of the truck showed the purpose of the farmer's drive into the city. The bodies of several large hogs lay in back, trussed and ready for delivery to the butcher. The driver's breakfast lay on the seat between them, a hunk of hard cheese and a roll of hard salami. The driver must have caught Cade looking, for he gestured at the food, mimed Cade having some.
Manger.
Thanks.
Cade helped himself to a small piece of each. He cut the same for the driver, and the two of them rode along in companionable silence, munching on their breakfast. Toulouse was the 6th largest metropolitan center in France, home to just over 1 million people. It sat on the bank of the River Garonne, some 150 kilometers east of the Mediterranean Sea, and served as home to some of the biggest companies in the French aerospace industry, such as Galileo, Airbus, and SPOT. As such, it not only had an excellent local airport, but a well-trafficked train station as well. The farmer led Cade off just inside the city limits near a local metro station.
Merci.
Cade headed for the station at a brisk walk. Once inside the terminal, he walked by the newsstand. The masthead of the local newspaper told him it was Friday morning, so he'd lost an entire day and a half while inside the Beyond. Hopefully, the necromancer had not grown impatient and nothing had happened to Gabrielle in the meantime. He spent a few minutes weighing his options. Flights out of Toulouse were all local, so he had to get to Paris in order to catch a plane back to the States. He could fly, but that would mean using his false passport again, and he would prefer to limit doing so as much as possible. Every use was a potential flag for the Order's tech geeks to trace him with. The train, on the other hand, would take considerably longer, but he didn't have to show ID in order to ride it, and wouldn't show up on any passenger manifest as a result. A quick check of the schedule showed a train leaving for Paris at 6:30 that morning, which put him into Paris in time to catch an afternoon flight back to New York. He could buy a ticket, then waste an hour or so prior to the train's departure sitting in a nearby cafe, drinking black coffee and thinking about how he was going to deal with things when he returned to the States. It was close to midnight, local time, when the helicopter carrying Echo's command team settled into the courtyard of the monastery in question. Riley could see a small group of monks gathered near the entrance to the cathedral, watching. By the time the rotors wound down enough for Riley to disembark, he saw that they had been joined by a tall, thin fellow who fit the description of Abbot Martin, the man with whom he'd been ordered to make contact. They'd flown from LaGuardia aboard the Order's Gulfstream to Paris and had taken the helicopter south from there, in the mountains and to the monastery itself. It was faster than driving and saved them from having to navigate the treacherous mountain roads on little sleep. The abbot was the only person at the monastery who was aware of the continued existence of the Templar Order. All senior church officials were, and so to protect the anonymity of Riley and his team, the rest of the monks had been told that they were a group of security specialists who'd been hired to keep this from happening again. Quite a few men in that profession were ex-military these days, and the cover story kept his men from having to be concerned about the way they looked and moved. Combat readiness was hard to disguise. This way, they didn't have to. Just another example of the Order's penchant for hiding in plain sight. Riley approached the abbot.
Matt Riley, sir. I understand you're expecting us?
That I am. Thank you for coming so quickly.
I only wish you'd called us sooner, sir. Let's see what we can do about keeping this from happening again, shall we?
The abbot nodded his agreement and led Riley over to the entrance to the sanctuary. When several of the spectators moved to follow, he gave them a hard stare that had them suddenly remembering other places they needed to be.
They don't mean any harm. They're just curious.
Of course.
However, Riley was thinking of the last time he'd been called to investigate the theft of a relic and the inside man who'd helped carry it off. He would speak to the other monks when he was done in the chapel, especially those who had found the injured man. Speaking of which...
I understand one of your people was injured. How's he doing?
The doctors tell me he is suffering from a cerebral edema as a result of the blow. The swelling of the brain is starting to interfere with bodily functions. We have him on the respirator and are doing everything we can to reduce the pressure. But the longer the blood flow is reduced, the more damage that's being caused.
I'm sorry to hear that, Abbot. My men will pray for you both.
The abbot led Riley into the chapel, and his gaze fell on the smashed mirror on the wall behind the reliquary. A few shards of glass still hung around the edge of the frame. But where he expected the floor to be littered with them, it was suspiciously clean. The hair on the back of his neck went up. He'd seen this kind of thing before.
Don't jump to conclusions.
The Sacred Hand has been with us for hundreds of years, and no one seemed to care. Then today, or rather yesterday, we get not just one, but two individuals who are interested in it.
I'm sorry, did you just say two? Assuming the first is whoever made off with it last night, who was the second?
The Monsignor from the Vatican, the one doing the inventory.
Who?
I told your preceptor about him and assumed he'd passed on the information. My apologies. We had a visit from a Monsignor Evans from the Sacred Office of the Propagation of the Faith yesterday afternoon. His Eminence, Cardinal Bollinger, has apparently ordered an inventory of some kind.
Can you describe this man to me?
Dark hair, average height and build, dressed as you would expect a Catholic priest to be dressed, but with an eye patch over one eye.
Do you remember which eye?
The right. No, the left. Sorry, I'm not certain.
The right side of the necromancer's face, especially the area around his eye socket, was hideously scarred, and it made sense that he might wear an eye patch to hide it. But the mirror...
Anything else you can remember?
You might think me crazy, but there was a strange energy about him. Like the feeling in the air when a raging summer storm is just about to break. He was unfailingly polite. Friendly, even, but at times I was afraid of him, I guess.
Not liking what he was hearing, Riley gestured to the floor beneath the reliquary.
Did your people clean up in here?
Good heavens, no. As soon as we discovered the theft, we moved Brother Samuel to the infirmary and then left the chapel exactly as we found it.
In an absurd way, Riley had been hoping, but there seemed no way around it now. It hadn't been the necromancer who'd stolen the hand. It had been Cade. Riley and his team spent the morning interviewing the personnel at the monastery, hoping to find that one piece of information that would tell them where their thief was headed, when they came up empty-handed. No one, except perhaps Brother Samuel, had seen anything, and Samuel wasn't talking. He was too busy fighting for his life as the edema caused by the blow to his head threatened to shut down the blood flow to his brain. Echo's commander desperately hoped this wouldn't become a murder investigation. After several hours of getting nowhere, the team packed up and headed back to Paris via helicopter. While en route, Riley used his phone to contact the head of the local commandery, giving him an update on what he had learned thus far. He did not mention Cade's involvement, not wanting to put his friend in the crosshairs quite yet. There was still too much Riley didn't know, and if some knight decided to shoot first and ask questions later, he'd have to live with that on his conscience for the rest of his life. That decision prevented him from putting out a bolo, or be-on-the-lookout warning for Cade, which meant Cade was likely going to be able to slip through security at the airport in Paris and return to the States before Riley had a chance to stop him, if he hadn't flown out already. He wasn't going to call out the cavalry and have every Tom, Dick, and Harry gunning for Cade until he knew more about the situation. By the time Cade arrived in Paris, he had come up with a plan for confronting the necromancer when the two of them met to hand over the relic. First, he had to get home. He took a taxi to the airport, and he headed for the ticket counter, then checked in for his flight without difficulty. He was starting to think all of his concerns had been for nothing when he looked up and saw Riley coming down the hall toward him. Cade was just passing a hallway that intersected with the one he was in and took advantage of the opportunity, ducking right and hoping like hell he hadn't been seen. He moved a good 10 feet down the corridor and then stood to one side of the hall, pretending to be talking on his cell phone while surreptitiously watching the entrance to the corridor. If Riley made the turn, but he didn't. Cade watched as he walked right on past, never even glancing in Cade's direction. Cade stayed where he was, watching, and seconds later he saw both Manny Ortega and Jimmy Martinez follow in Riley's wake. That left only Simmons from Echo's command team unaccounted for. Cade waited another moment or two for the missing man to arrive, but to no avail. Perhaps Simmons had been walking ahead of Riley. It didn't really matter one way or the other. What mattered was what they were doing here.
And there's at least one way to find out.
Riley dug the cell phone out of his pocket and glanced down at the display, noting that the incoming number was blocked. Very few people had his number, and those that did would have no reason to block their incoming line.
Hello?
I hear you're in Paris.
Where I am doesn't matter. I'm more interested in where the hell you are. Do you know how much trouble you dropped me into?
Sorry about that, but I didn't have a choice. Nor do I when I tell you to get clear of this thing.
What thing? Tracking the necromancer? Kind of hard to do at this point, don't you think?
It doesn't matter what I think. Trust me when I tell you that you need to stay out of this.
I'm the one who called you in on it, remember?
Riley slowed his pace, letting the others get a few yards ahead of him so they wouldn't be able to hear his end of the conversation and know that he was talking with Cade.
That may be, but things have changed. I need to deal with this my way, and I can't have the Order screwing it up.
Deal with what? What are you talking about? Are you in some kind of trouble?
There was silence on Cade's end.
Come on, man. Give me something. I've been to your house. I saw the room upstairs. Does this have something to do with Gabrielle? You want to know why I'm in Paris, Cade? I'm here because of the theft of a relic that's hundreds of years old. You wouldn't happen to know anything about that, would you?
More silence.
They say that the old man might not make it. Seems the blow to his head had caused some internal bleeding and pressure that they can't seem to stop. Look, man, Johansson is suggesting that you were involved with Logan's escape. I'm supposed to bring you in so we can all clear the air and get this nonsense taken care of properly.
Johansson's an asshole.
True, but that doesn't mean we can just ignore him. Whatever it is that you're dealing with, why not come in, have your say, and then let the Order help you deal with it?
Rescuing Duncan.
Riley didn't have an answer for that. 3 months before, the youngest and newest member of the Echo team, Sergeant Sean Duncan, had been captured by a horde of blood-sucking Chinese vampires known as the Changshi. They had taken him beyond the curtain to the elemental plane known as the Beyond and had tortured him for information. Duncan had survived that, only to fall into the hands of Cade's most fervent enemy, the adversary. Cade had been preparing to take the Echo team across the curtain to rescue him when Johansson had ordered the team to stand down. Even worse, he'd gone straight to the Seneschal, Cade's direct report, to get him to forbid the team from making the attempt. Cade was right. He shouldn't expect any help from the Order, especially not with the Preceptor already gunning for him.
I don't want to see you get hurt, Riley, but if you interfere, that's exactly what's going to happen. Keep your head down and stay out of my way, you hear?
As he hung up the phone, Cade thought back over his conversation with Riley and smiled in satisfaction. He'd learned what he needed to know, namely that someone had connected the theft of the relic to what was going on with the Necromancer. If they hadn't, they wouldn't have sent Riley over here. That didn't bother Cade as much as how quickly it had all happened. It hadn't been 48 hours since he'd taken the hand. He thought he'd have another day, possibly even two, before connections would start being made.
No matter. What's done is done. I'll have to move on to Phase 2 quicker than I'd planned, but so be it. I just hope Riley is up for what comes next.